Protesters across the country, including Phoenix, are demanding action after a series of police killings of unarmed suspects. I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, perspectives on the national dialogue on race, violence, and the police.
In some communities, I have to be honest, I don't know that trust can be rebuilt. I do know that some of the steps that need to be taken are really to be accountable.
The Phoenix Police Department does not plan to be one of those communities.
When we have waited or we have not responded and given the community leaders the facts that we have at the time, that's when it starts to erode that trust.
Also today, Arizona joins the multi-state lawsuit challenging the president's action on immigration. Joe Arpaio is one step closer to being in contempt, a different approach to wellness, plus a Tempe icon could get a makeover and a community of fighters. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. What you see outside right now is what you should expect for the rest of the afternoon. Partly sunny skies with a high of 74 degrees. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. Then mostly cloudy skies for tomorrow. Slight chance of rain and a high of 74 degrees. It's 69 degrees right now at KJZZ. And checking the Valley freeways, really nothing to check. No major problem spots to tell you about right now. The cost of gas is continuing to drop across the state and the country. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, Arizona hasn't seen prices this low in 4 years.
$2.66. That's the average price for a gallon of regular gas in Arizona this week. And in some spots around the valley, it's under $2.50. And it's probably going to go lower. That's AAA's projection. Michelle Donati is a spokesperson for the association.
AAA is projecting that prices could drop another 15 to 20 cents per gallon in the near term because retail prices right now still have to catch up with steep declines in both the cost of crude oil and wholesale gasoline.
And Donati says OPEC's decision to maintain oil production is helping maintain those declines. Arizona's gas prices are down more than 50 cents from the same time last year. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Governor Jan Brewer is in Hawaii to attend ceremonies marking the 73rd anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The governor plans to attend Sunday's memorial at Pearl Harbor, visit the sunken hulk of the USS Arizona, and then make a visit to a modern warship named for an Arizona city, the attack submarine USS Tucson. Brewer took part in the ceremony last year marking the anniversary of the December 7, 1941 attack that sunk the Arizona, as well as numerous other warships. It also killed about 2,400 sailors, Marines, and soldiers. Of those, 1,177 were on the Arizona when it exploded after being hit by Japanese bombs. Brewer plans to meet with some of the 9 surviving Arizona sailors. She's the first Arizona governor to attend the annual ceremonies. Protesters took to the streets in Phoenix last night to express their frustration over the shooting death earlier this week of Romaine Brisbane. Brisbane was African-American and unarmed, and he was shot by a white police officer who said he thought Brisbane was reaching for a gun. The object turned out to be a pill bottle. This comes on the heels of protests across the country over decisions not to indict police officers in New York City and Ferguson, Missouri, for the killings of unarmed African-American men. Today we have 3 perspectives, starting with Tia Oso. She's the Arizona organizer for Black Alliance for Just Immigration. I asked her what she makes of what's been happening over the last few weeks.
It's a national epidemic, and it's an American issue. We even have the same type of police violence happening in Black communities and also in brown communities here in Arizona. And my reaction is that, you know, why is it not evident to everyone what a problem this is? Every 28 hours, a Black man, woman, or child is killed either by a police officer or some type of law enforcement officer, a vigilante, or a security officer every 28 hours. So that's almost every day it happens. But really, police violence and police killings are just one symptom of this continuum that we have of racial inequality and racial injustice and state violence. And so state violence means, you know, racial and social inequality. State violence means defunding of our schools. State violence means poverty and cuts to social welfare. There are a lot of different ways that Black communities are under attack right now before you get to someone being killed by the police. And for people to react as though African Americans and Black folks are just overreacting or we're not being rational or we're disrespecting the police is heartbreaking to me.
How do you think that police departments can sort of regain the trust of communities that have been affected by this kind of violence?
So in some communities, I have to be honest, I don't know that trust can be rebuilt. I do know that some of the steps that need to be taken are really to be accountable. There needs to be police accountability. There need to be ramifications for officers that are killing unarmed civilians. There needs to be consequences. If these are public servants and people who are hired to protect and serve, there needs to be public accountability as well. So I do think that what we're seeing now and what you're seeing a lot of the outrage is that there hasn't been any type of due process at all. The fact that there was no indictment in the Eric Garner case, no indictment in Michael Brown's case, no indictment in Cleveland with John Crawford. So we don't even see justice and due process being carried out.
We've seen a lot of discussion about having discussions about police departments and other law enforcement agencies going into communities and having dialogue with mm-hmm. people in those communities. Is that a good step or is that just sort of lip service, do you think?
I think it's lip service. I think that we're in a cycle right now of tragedies in Black communities where there's a violation that happens. The community gets outraged. You know, high-level staff at the police force try to calm everyone down in the general public, and then they say, okay, we're going to have a conversation. We're going to have a dialogue. We're going to rebuild trust. And I think, honestly, we have this issue where we're not really confronting the real problem. The real problem is, I believe, a lack of preparation and really a lack of understanding on behalf of the police force. It's not that we don't know enough about police, and it's not that we don't understand enough, you know, what their job is like and how hard it is. I think everybody has respect for how hard it is for police to put their life on the line in order to go out on the streets and try to accomplish their mission of keeping us safe. I don't think that's the issue. I think that there is something deeper going on. I think it has to do with training, and I do think it has to do with this culture of criminalization of Black communities, where Black people are generally seen as dangerous, as a threat, as criminals, as thugs. That needs to change. And some type of new conversation would have to go on in order to change that.
Why do you think it is that the case this week in Phoenix has not become a situation like what we saw in Ferguson, what we saw in New York City?
So Phoenix is a little bit different. Our communities are not as concentrated, okay, in urban areas. And then also we don't have as high of an African-American and Black population here. And we're a little bit spread out also, right? So it takes us a little while to get the news and things to reverberate. I would say that I heard about Mike Brown's killing much quicker than I did about Romaine Brisbane's killing here in Phoenix. It took about a day before I found out what had happened.
Do you think that depending on what happens with the officer involved in the shooting, that Phoenix could see protests similar to what we've seen in Missouri and New York?
Definitely. The situation in Phoenix, even though it may not be as tense, there's still similar conditions. So you still have social inequality happening. You still have a lack of police accountability and a lack of transparency in these killings. And then you have families and communities that are looking for answers, and they're tired of waiting and they're tired of being let down by the justice system.
Tia Oso is the Arizona organizer for Black Alliance for Just Immigration. We hear next from the Phoenix Police Department. In addition to the shooting earlier this week, the agency was involved in a high-profile case in August in which an officer shot and killed a mentally ill woman while on a call to bring her to a mental health facility. Gerald Richard is assistant to Phoenix Police Chief Daniel Garcia and works on police community relations.
I say that we have a very strong relationship between the police department and communities of color in Phoenix, and the reason being is that this is something that we've been working on since 1991, as far as open dialogue between our communities, all of our communities, and the Phoenix Police Department, because we realized that by establishing an ongoing relationship with our communities, when times like what has recently occurred, not only in the nation but also in Phoenix, when situations occur, I should say, during times like this, that's when that relationship comes into play.
Do you think that relationship is strong enough to survive the legal process for the officer involved in the shooting of the young man earlier this week?
I believe that it is. We have a community response squad and the officers that support that squad throughout the entire department as far as the ongoing dialogue that's necessary, whether it's planning a meeting, whether it's planning, and it could be a meeting to protest against the police department, whether it's assisting as far as the march that we saw last night. It is critical, and I can't even express the gratitude that I've been hearing from last night through this morning just dealing with last night, not all the other demonstrations that we've seen here in Phoenix. And that's one of the reasons why we're blessed here. And that is because we do have that relationship.
How do you foster that? I mean, is it more than just going into communities and talking to folks?
You know, that's the first thing as far as going into communities and talking. But it's also as far as supporting communities and different organizations, being seen right there with your community, celebrating with your community, feeling their pain when that time occurs as well, attending funerals, just letting them know that we care and we appreciate that ongoing relationship. It's a family. It is truly like a family. And if a family is constantly talking and working together, you can get through the rough times. And this is one of those times. But we'll get through this.
Do you find that events in other places affect the relationship that the Phoenix Police Department has with its community?
Events in other places highlight the concerns that citizens may share with other places, such as in Ferguson, such as New York. And it also provides individuals who may have some disconnect as far as government, authority, even the law enforcement community. And what it does is it allows them during that time to go ahead and vet their frustrations or their anger. But it also, by doing that and by coming out and doing that, it allows us to reach out to them and establish a relationship with them as well.
Do you foresee any changes in the Phoenix Police Department, either in training or in some kinds of protocol, based on the incident earlier this week here and incidents in New York and in Ferguson?
As far as that is concerned, right now, I can't say there is, except for the fact that I know the police chief is very concerned about making sure that every other year the officers have updated cultural awareness training. You may also know that most recently we had another officer-involved shooting involving an individual that was suffering from mental illness, and the chief is also pushing that to make sure that we respond accordingly as far as our officers having the best training they can possibly have.
At what point, if at all, do you start worrying about losing the trust of the communities that you're serving, especially when right now, when there have been what seem to be sort of a spate of officer-involved shootings that follow sort of a similar pattern?
You know, one of the things that we have is an unwritten protocol, and that is when we have an incident like this, we immediately get on the phone and we contact members within the community, and we let them know what happens before they see it on the news. And by doing that, they at least have the initial facts so that if someone calls them, they can respond. Because the most frustrating thing is when you have community members calling community leaders, and community leaders have no answers at all. What we have found over the years is that when we have waited or we have not responded and given the community leaders the facts that we have at the time, that's when it starts to erode that trust.
Gerald Richard is assistant to Phoenix Police Chief Daniel Garcia. So much of what we hear these days about law enforcement activities comes not from a police report, but Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Lori Stevens is a social media strategist for law enforcement. Lori, how is this changing the way police are communicating with the people they're sworn to serve?
Well, it certainly increases their ability to get right to the people without being filtered in any way by the media. And by filtering, I just mean, you know, sometimes the media covers a story and it doesn't cover the story in the way that maybe the police would prefer that they did, or it doesn't cover it at all because it's not, you know, a big enough story or juicy enough or what have you. And so now, you know, the police have the opportunity not only just to tell their stories, to tell more of their stories, but to tell them directly to the public. And so, it benefits them in that way. There's a lot of criticism sometimes, I think, because people will say, especially the media, will say, well, you know, you need us to be that gatekeeper and really make sure that what's being told to the public is the truth and so forth and so on. And that's true. Of course, we need the media. But I think what happens is as the news consumers are doing more and more of that filtering themselves through social media or whatever means they choose to. And so it increases a news consumer's ability to get information as well, and then increases the chance that they're going to be building. I'm talking about the law enforcement now. Law enforcement is able to, by doing this, really start to build relationships with the community members, and because then it's a two-way street. Those community members are going to be more likely to want to help law enforcement.
It could also, it seems to me, though, it also could pose a problem to law enforcement when you have eyewitnesses or other people in the community posting things perhaps before the police department is ready to talk about them, or things that might be contrary to what the law enforcement agency is saying.
Absolutely, and that has happened. We've seen a few cases of that where I'm thinking of one case a few years back when a little boy went missing, and it was out in on the West Coast, and, you know, people in the community were outing the stepmother, and the police weren't necessarily looking at her yet, or at least didn't want people to know that they were, and it caused their case to move along a little faster than they wanted it to, and sometimes it can really undermine the case, and there's just dozens and dozens of examples like that.
In general, do you find that law enforcement agencies are using social media and using it well, using it to their best purpose for their purposes?
There certainly are pockets, I think, in the country of, you know, geographically, where there's more agencies who really have their head around this stuff probably more than some of the other areas. I'm thinking, you know, many California agencies are doing well, many Texas agencies are doing well. So those are, you know, examples of some pockets where agencies are really approaching it strategically and proactively, and then benefiting from it. Because when you do that and you're using it well, when you don't need the support of the public and you're communicating with them and you're engaging with them, you're able to influence your image and your reputation. Plus, then when something happens and you need the public support, you'll have it because you've built those relationships and that trust with that community.
Lori Stevens is a social media consultant dealing with law enforcement. Lori, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up, an iconic Tempe structure that stood vacant for 20 years could become a new hotel and music venue.
I think everyone's going to really want to see what this looks like and how they pay homage to the Hayden Flour Mill.
That's ahead. It's the show. Look for partly sunny skies across the valley for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 74 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tomorrow with a high once again of 74. Sunny skies on Sunday with a high of 77. It's 71 degrees at KJZZ at 221.
KJZZ is supported by Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center, creating customized plans with cancer treatment options for all cancer types. Information at BannerMDAnderson.com. We are all in for the fight against cancer.
Sheriff's deputies in southern Utah are serving evictions today on several homes in Hilldale, part of Warren Jaffe's polygamous sect. Brady McCombs in Salt Lake City has been covering the story for the Associated Press.
Evictions of seven homes in Warren Jaffe's polygamous community on the Utah-Arizona border are underway Friday. The evictions are the first since the state took control of the trust in 2005 due to allegations of mismanagement by Jaffe's and other sect leaders.
Are there people living in these homes now?
I just spoke with an official who works for Utah and helps run the trust, and he said it appears today that some of the homes had people in them and others did not. There were reports that the sect was moving people out of the homes in anticipation of the evictions ahead of this.
Do we have any sense of, for the folks who are living there, where they're going to go?
It looks like they'll be moving around and continuing to live within the community. Most of these people are loyal followers of Warren Jaffe's, and they refuse to pay, arguing that they shouldn't have to pay the state any money for homes they built and maintained. All these homes are in a trust that was created in 1942 by this religious group down there. Nobody has deeds to the homes, and people live in the homes with the permission of church leaders who give people homes and places to live if they're being loyal followers.
How did we get here? I mean, how did the state get involved in whether or not people are paying to live in these homes?
Well, the state of Utah took over this trust back in 2005 over allegations of mismanagement by Warren Jaffe and other leaders. Warren Jaffe and his other people never contested in court those allegations, so the state took it over in 2005, hoping to have it just for a little bit and get it back in the hands of the people. But due to a host of lawsuits and other legal issues, this trust has been hung up in the courts now for 9 years. The ultimate goal here is to create a board of community members who will then make the decisions about who gets which homes. We're talking about more than 700 homes and properties worth more than $100 million. But the judge here does not want to create the board, until they have this income coming in of the occupancy fees, the $100 a month fees that people are supposed to be paying. Those were instituted to keep people accountable, and everybody that lived in the home supposedly signed agreements saying they were going to do this.
The judge's order that cleared the way for the evictions, does that apply to any homes outside of Utah? I'm thinking in Colorado City, which is right there on the border as well, or is this just Utah?
For now, it's just Utah, and the big reason is because in Colorado City, they still have not subdivided the homes, and so there's no way to logistically do it. For now, they started in Hilldale, and they started with just one group of homes, one batch of homes, with the hope of sending a message and spurring people to pay. They grabbed a batch of homes, 26 homes. 12 of the people in those homes did agree to pay and avoided evictions. 14 of the homes did not. So 7 of them are being evicted today. The other 7 are expected to be evicted soon, but they're not there yet.
Brady McCombs writes for the Associated Press in Salt Lake City. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is one step closer to facing contempt charges for not following a federal judge's orders after that judge found the sheriff's office had systematically racially profiled Latinos. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block, who was in court yesterday. Hi, Jude.
Hi there.
So set the scene for us. Why did the judge set this hearing and who was there?
So the judge wound up outlining his case for why he believes he must proceed with pursuing contempt charges against the sheriff and potentially command staff for repeatedly violating his orders. So Sheriff Arpaio was there. He sat at the defense counsel table. And next to him, there was a new face in court, Mel McDonald, Arpaio's newly hired criminal defense attorney. Also there were some representatives of the Tucson U.S. Attorney's Office. Since if the judge pursues criminal contempt, he'll need to appoint a prosecutor to pursue those charges.
So what are the violations that the judge is so upset about that he's even considering contempt?
Well, there have been a lot of issues that have made this judge frustrated, but he mentioned a specific concern in court on Thursday. That has to do with the fact that as early as 2011, Judge Murray Snow gave a pretrial order to the sheriff's office to stop arresting drivers and passengers just on suspicion that they were in the country illegally. But deputies continued with those activities, and they continued even longer than we'd previously realized. And now new evidence shows that the sheriff's commanders may have failed to ever even notify line officers that Snow had ordered them to stop.
But in the end, the judge didn't initiate any action yesterday. It was just more threats of contempt?
Yeah, this seemed to be round one of the process. The judge explained his plan. He wants to start with civil contempt proceedings. And then if he decides civil penalties aren't enough, at that point he'd appoint a federal prosecutor to pursue criminal contempt proceedings. But he's letting the attorneys from both sides weigh in on this plan. He gave them until January 8th to submit briefs on this.
So what kind of penalties could Sheriff Arpaio face if it does get to the point of criminal contempt?
There could be fines or even incarceration. The judge did mention he'd be interested in compensating victims in Maricopa County who were wronged by these violations. But at the same time, he said, you know, he doesn't want the sheriff to just use more taxpayer money to pay those fines. So that's going to be an interesting point to watch. The other thing to note is that it isn't just the sheriff on the line here. Judge Snow said in court that some command staff should also hire criminal defense attorneys.
Jude, as we've noted many times, the sheriff is extremely PR savvy. I wonder if he'll be able to turn this discipline, this whole incident from the federal judge around to his benefit to actually maybe mobilize some of his supporters, help him fundraise for future elections.
Yeah, and that point isn't lost on the judge. He said in court that Arpaio, when he met one of the court-appointed monitors, actually said he loves these confrontations with the courts because they boost his popularity. So I think Judge Snow is thinking about how do you sanction someone in this kind of a situation.
Much more to come on this. Jude will be staying on top of it. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Governor Jan Brewer yesterday afternoon announced Arizona would join the multi-state lawsuit that aims to overturn President Obama's recent executive actions on immigration. Texas is leading that effort. With Arizona, there are now 18 states on the suit. But Arizona wasn't one of the states that originally filed suit on Wednesday, although it's already involved in a similar case over the president's deferred action for childhood arrivals program. State Representative John Kavanaugh is happy Arizona signed on to this new suit.
come down on the side of the U.S. Constitution and the checks and balances that protect us from, you know, one branch overpowering the others.
Do you think that Arizona has any different interests or arguments in this case than other states involved?
Well, I think we all have the same argument in terms of the integrity of the Constitution and not allowing the executive branch to basically breach the separation of powers. But on a more practical note, because Arizona has a larger proportion of illegal immigrants than other states, at a practical level, we have a greater interest in winning this case.
What did you make of the fact that Arizona wasn't one of the original states on this suit?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. I wasn't involved, so I can't comment.
Were you surprised that Arizona joined on a day later?
No. I suspect that the fact that we're having the transition in attorneys general may have been the reason for the original delay, but Governor Brewer stepped up, so all's well that ends well.
Arizona is already fighting a lawsuit similar in some ways to this one over the governor's policy of not providing driver's licenses to kids covered by the president's DACA program. Do you see similarities between that case and this one?
Well, there's similarities in that in both cases, the president is using an executive order to perform a legislative congressional function, so he's violating the Arizona Constitution. And by the same token, this would... the action also encourages illegal immigration, which has a greater negative economic effect on Arizona because of our proximity to the border and a larger number of illegal immigrants.
So given those similarities, I mean, does it make sense for Arizona to sort of be involved in both of these suits when we're already fighting one of them?
Arizona should be involved in any and all suits that attempt to maintain the integrity of the U.S. Constitution and that also protect Arizona from the negative economic and social consequences of illegal immigration.
Do you expect the states, including Arizona, to have better success in the courts on this lawsuit than what Arizona is having with the DACA lawsuit?
I should hope so. I think this lawsuit is really bringing to a head President Obama's failure to comply with the U.S. Constitution, which requires him to faithfully execute the laws, and also the Administrative Procedures Act, which states that an executive agency can only perform executive functions. And by giving these people the right to work here, the executive branch has moved into the legislative branch.
Given that Arizona is fighting the DACA lawsuit on its own and expending its own resources, are you hopeful that this coalition of states fighting the most recent executive actions will pool resources and Arizona maybe won't have to spend as much time and money on it?
Well, I would certainly like that, but I'm not about to abrogate my right to appeal illegal federal action because I have to pay the bill myself.
State Representative John Kavanaugh. The state hasn't been too successful in court in the DACA case. A federal appeals court has blocked the governor's policy of not issuing driver's licenses to people in the program. She plans to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mari Elena Encapie is executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, which is the lead counsel on the DACA case. She's not surprised Arizona joined the multi-state suit.
So it's not a surprise. I have to say I was actually surprised yesterday when I didn't see Arizona listed on the first round when the complaint was first filed. You know, in our lawsuits against the state anti-immigrant laws, including Arizona, Utah, Indiana, Georgia, South Carolina, and Alabama, every single one of those states has also joined this lawsuit. So it's not a surprise that states that have tried the self-deportation approach, for example, and tried to make life miserable for not just undocumented immigrants, but for anybody that appears to be an immigrant are part of this lawsuit.
What does it say to you that Arizona is joining this lawsuit when it's already involved in what seems to be a very similar kind of legal argument on the DACA case?
Well, I think on the DACA case, they're specifically challenging the ability of individuals with deferred action to obtain driver's licenses. So it has much more to do with the eligibility for a state program such as driver's licenses. In joining the federal lawsuit along with Texas and the other 16 states, they're trying to challenge the deferred action program at its core. I haven't read the complaint, so I can't opine on the lawsuit particularly, but we do know very clearly, and this isn't just the National Immigration Law Center, but the overwhelming majority of legal scholars, immigration law professors, constitutional law professors, all believe that President Obama has broad legal authority, which is derived from existing statutes, regulations, Supreme Court decisions, including even the most recent decision against Arizona in 2012, where the Supreme Court there held very clearly that a principal feature of the immigration system is that the executive branch has broad discretion to exercise removal, and in doing so, it can actually embrace human concerns, including whether someone has long-term ties to the United States or whether they have children in the United States.
So you don't see the two cases as being repetitive for one state to be involved in. You see them as on different tracks here, at least what the lawsuits are arguing here.
That's right. They're related cases, I would say, although they are arguing, the arguments seem to be completely different.
As you well know, being involved in at least some of these cases, Arizona joining a lawsuit or being involved in a lawsuit against the federal government is not necessarily news or an unusual event. Is there anything that you take away from all of these various lawsuits, both on immigration and in some cases some other issues, that Arizona and the feds are butting heads on issues?
I think Arizona has been an outlier. Interestingly, in this recent round of lawsuits that we've had against state anti-immigrant laws, we have been able to settle all of those lawsuits in the other states except Arizona. Arizona is very much fighting tooth and nail every step of the way in both the SB 1070 and the DACA lawsuit.
Marielena Encapier is Executive Director of the National Immigration Law Center. Marielena, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a community that trains together stays together.
I loved the training. I mean, the training, that's the easy part, really. Where I found that I wasn't cut out for boxing was actually getting in the ring and getting hit.
That's ahead. It's the show. In Valley traffic, the ramp connecting the 60 eastbound to the Loop 101 northbound is closed due to an accident. You want to avoid that area. Again, the ramp connecting the 60 eastbound to the 101 northbound is closed. Partly sunny skies, 71 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners and catered party trays, fine wines paired with artisan cheeses, and festive desserts for all your entertaining needs. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Richard Lee Harris. The managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine is now casting doubt on the sensational story it published last month and is questioning the credibility of a woman in the article who alleged she was gang-raped at a University of Virginia fraternity. Beverly Amsler reports from member station WVTF.
The article focused on a student identified as Jackie, who recounted being brutally gang-raped by seven men at a frat party 2 years ago. That sent shockwaves through the university community, resulting in protests and initiating an independent investigation by the state attorney general's office. Now the magazine's managing editor, Will Dana, says new information has come to light questioning Jackie's credibility. Fraternity officials say there was no party at the Phi Kappa Psi house that weekend. The name of an alleged attacker didn't belong to that fraternity, and he never met Jackie. And the Washington Post reports some of Jackie's close friends and confidants are doubtful of some of the details. For NPR News, I'm Beverly Amsler in Roanoke.
An upbeat report from the Labor Department. Employers added 321,000 new jobs in November, the most in 3 years. The unemployment rate remains at a six-year low of 5.8%. President Obama is hailing today's numbers.
Over the last 4 years, we've put more people back to work than Europe, Japan, and all other industrialized advanced countries combined. And we're going to keep at it until every single American who is willing and able to work can find not just any job, but a job that pays a decent wage and allows them to support their family.
The government also revised the September and October numbers, saying there were a combined 44,000 more jobs added to the workforce. A strong jobs report lifted stocks today. The Dow Jones Industrials up 58 points today to 17,958. The NASDAQ rose 11. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The old Hayden Flour Mill is getting a makeover. The Tempe City Council has preliminary plans to turn the nearly 100-year-old landmark into a hotel and outdoor amphitheater. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports on what happened at last night's council meeting.
The big concrete mill is visible along the north end of Mill Avenue in downtown Tempe. It was built in 1918 and was used for flour production for the next 80 years. Since then, it's been vacant. The Tempe Historic Preservation Foundation's Darlene Justice is excited to see the building getting some attention again.
I think that this could be something great as long as they're sensitive and take care to not destroy that building.
The mill has a National Historic Preservation designation, and Tempe's working on a local designation. Councilman Colby Granville says he's aware of the building's importance to the city's history.
Council agrees. We have to keep the mill. We have to keep the silos. The way we can afford to do it is by wrapping it in development and making the development around it and the tax revenue from that pay for the historic preservation.
The mill sits at the base of Hayden Butte Preserve, also known as A Mountain. The preserve's protected from development above about 1,200 feet. Granville says the council's excited about BOM Development Group's plans for the property because the city council wants to make Mill Avenue a vibrant entertainment district, adding to the already existing bars and restaurants.
20 years ago, that was being done largely by bars with stages. There aren't really bars with stages for bands on Mill Avenue anymore. So the city is looking for ways to create venues where we can bring in or work with private vendors to bring in bands and bring live music and entertainment to Mill Avenue on Friday and Saturday nights.
Preservationists are cautiously optimistic. Justice says she wants to make sure historically important parts of the mill are preserved and incorporated into the design.
If things cannot be used in the mill, I hope that they go to the Tempe History Museum. But I think it's very important that they tell the story of the Hayden family.
Developers have tried to build on the property before with no success. But Granville attributes that to the economy, not the property. The council passed an ordinance Thursday night requiring the developer to do something with the property within 2 years of buying it.
And the reason we're doing that is we don't want someone to buy a piece of land, get some entitlements on it that add value to the land, and then basically sit on it, land bank it, do nothing with it, and let us just have a vacant parcel.
If the developer doesn't at least have a plan for development, they could lose the property. There's no construction timeline and won't be until the city completes a development deal. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Tempe.
A Scottsdale telemarketing firm and a sheriff's union in Texas were recently called into question when their fundraising activities weren't disclosed to the state as required by Texas law. As KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, Arizona had similar rules until last year when a new law removed most regulation of nonprofit fundraising.
PFR Promotions in Scottsdale began telemarketing for a Texas sheriff's union last year, raising money for a Shop with a Sheriff charity event for needy kids. But they came under media scrutiny a month ago because the union wasn't registered with the state as required, and PFR wasn't telling donors how much of their contributions actually went toward charity, which is against Texas law. PFR also works with the Scottsdale Police Union, and both groups previously had to follow similar laws in Arizona. But when the firm tried to renew its registration last year, the Secretary of State's office sent it back. That's because a new law had kicked in that removed all registration and reporting requirements for nonprofits and their for-profit solicitors. Basically, almost all regulation of nonprofit fundraising in Arizona is now gone. State Representative Paul Boyer sponsored the legislation last year.
It's a waste of resources. It's a hassle for the Secretary of State, or for his office, the employees there, and also for the charity that has to come down and drive all the way down just to file redundant paperwork.
He's talking about the annual tax returns that nonprofits have to file with the IRS, which they also filed with the Arizona Secretary of State as part of their annual registration. But the state didn't verify the information, and with tax records now so easily found online, Boyer says it was a pointless law, so he got rid of it. But his bill also got rid of reporting requirements for for-profit solicitors like PFR that raise money for charity. They also don't have to be bonded anymore, nor do they have to tell potential donors who they really are, telemarketers. Boyer seemed surprised when KJZZ brought this up, and when asked if this was maybe an accident, an oversight.
It could have been.
He says he wanted to remove red tape for only nonprofits, not contracted fundraisers, and he plans to look into what happened. Patrick McWhorter at the Alliance of Arizona Nonprofits says the bill was poorly drafted, and the law didn't need a big overhaul in the first place.
We were claiming, and still do, that being one of the few states that does not have any kind of regulation for fundraising would make us a haven for fundraising scams.
He says that while the old law didn't necessarily stop bad actors, it was an extra tool for state prosecutors when going after them. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
Wellness through storytelling. That's one of the goals of an event tomorrow called the Gathering of Native Americans Winter Storytelling Workshop. It's put on by the Phoenix Indian Center and features historic stories that have been handed down over time that can be interpreted to address today's issues. Patty Hibbler is the Phoenix Indian Center's CEO.
What it does is it's a day-long workshop that takes individuals through the cultural wellness and teachings that are found in almost all American Indian cultures. So those are the four kind of pieces that we see on the medicine wheel for healing: belonging, certainly that people are feeling part of something and belonging, mastery, that there's certainly a mastery of skill levels at each age of your development. There is interdependence as our adolescents kind of move into that adulthood. And then the fourth is really that feeling of generosity.
What's the thought process between doing this kind of thing through storytelling versus a lecture or some other kind of workshop?
So doing it through storytelling is how we as American Indian people have told our history for thousands of years. It's really been through telling stories and then having dialogue about how that story really applies itself to our life as we live it today. Because even those very old historical stories have great relevance in what we do today. And so that's really our way of kind of handing off and passing down history over time.
Is it just a little more relatable maybe to the audience you're trying to reach?
Well, I think it's very much more relatable because many of them have heard similar stories from their aunties and uncles or grandparents or, you know, mom and dad.
So what do you hope that folks who come to this event will take away from it?
We really hope a way that they first, number one, is taking away a feeling of community. As Native people, we live all over the valley. We don't live together in one area like you know. And the interesting thing is that we're all from somewhere, right? So we're all from a tribe or a reservation, and that's what makes us Native. So this is our way to really come together and see how we're living as American Indian people living this urban experience here in Phoenix, and how we can contribute and give back to our community in several ways, whether it's working with our Native community or the overall community in Phoenix, being good contributors and really being a part of, you know, the decision making and what happens in our own place where we live in the city.
Is it harder to sort of carry on the cultural traditions when you live in an urban center like Phoenix as opposed to maybe on a reservation or in a more clustered area?
That's a really good question because it is much more difficult. When you're in a much more clustered area with other Native people and you're on the reservation, there are ceremonies, there are, you know, feasts, there are activities that are happening that the whole Native community participates in because the Native community is the dominant community on the reservation. Here it's actually the opposite. So we have to actually seek out those types of opportunities to gather and come together with other Native people for different celebrations or different activities. So one of the things we always hear from people that we interact with at the Phoenix Indian Center is that our center has really become a home away from home for them.
Patty Hibbler is CEO of the Phoenix Indian Center. Patty, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Look for partly sunny skies, partly cloudy skies, whatever you want to call it, around the valley the rest of the afternoon with a high of 74 degrees. Partly cloudy skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-50s. Right now in Phoenix, it's partly cloudy, 71 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of a community in a series called We Are the Valley. And this week, we take a look at boxing. It's been known as the sweet science, but many of us think of it as a sport where two people punch each other. Steve found that some boxers help support their fellow fighters both inside and outside the ring.
The Iron Boy Boxing Gym near Broadway and 37th Street isn't full of mirrors or treadmills. The lights are dim and there's a frequent background noise from a cabinet maker next door. Two rings, one full size, take up most of the nearly 2,000 square foot space. This place is about boxing, plain and simple. Emily Pandalakis decided about 5 years ago that she wanted to train to be a fighter. The training continued. The fighting, not so much.
I loved the training. I mean, the training, that's the easy part, really. Where I found that I wasn't cut out for boxing was actually getting in the ring and getting hit. I'm not gonna lie. I realized when I got tired training, I would step away from the bag. And when you get tired in the ring, they hit you more.
But the environment around the gym and its unique community feel was something Pandalakis still wanted to be a part of.
It's a very raw sense of community because people are all such good friends. They've all been around this since they were little kids. You know, Juan Varela just walked in, and he's been around the sport since he was barely walking, I'm sure. You know, and these people, they are helping each other, giving each other tips. They're, you know, socializing.
Did it take any time for you to be accepted as a woman in this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to be honest, in Phoenix, boxing is a largely Latino community, and I'm also white, and that was a difference too. You know, I mean, I've learned a lot of Spanish, and I think certainly now that I'm accepted and people are, you know, very kind to me. But it is, you know, to have anybody respect your opinion. You're a girl. What do you know?
I started fighting when I was 8. Started training at 7.
Juan Varela grew up in South Phoenix, not far from Iron Boy. He helps coach and train young people at the gym, and he doesn't do it for the money.
We actually probably lose money from the gas and time and everything, but for us it's an investment in our future, it's an investment in the kids' lives and everything.
Varela says the boxing gym is a microcosm of life, including people from different backgrounds and with different goals.
That's the way a community is. A community is there to help you out, to support you, to be there with you, maybe to rebuke you and get on you when you're doing wrong. You can have, you know, all the money in the world, be privileged and do bad things, or you could have nothing and work hard at it and pick yourself up and move and motivate and encourage and you know, have a positive impact on, and influence on other people.
Emily Pandalakis wanted to be a part of that too. Last spring, she was hired to help promote the gym and some of its young fighters. But it's much more than a job to her.
I've gotten to be really close with a lot of these kids. I have maternal feelings for them. And so, you know, I know a lot of their stories and a lot of what they're doing and what they're going through. And, you know, there's kids that I started with when I started in boxing that are, you know, growing up and going pro. And it's awesome.
Steve Goldstein, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you're part of a community, tell us about it for our We Are the Valley series. Send us a note, wearethevalley@kjzz.org. Sometimes it can seem like machines are taking over. They sell us our groceries, check us in at the airport, and even communicate with us on the phone. That's especially true in Britain, where London Underground workers recently held a strike to protest plans to replace ticket offices run by people with automated machines. The BBC's Tom Bateman looks into where this robot revolution is heading and how much more of it humans are willing to put up with.
Please select from popular items or look up item alphabetically.
You've just walked out of the supermarket here. Did you use the machine or the human being?
I did actually use the machine, but it was only for a couple of things. Did a pain in backside.
Why?
It moves from a tarot bagging area, innit?
It's already in the bagging area.
And we went in, and there was one person and about a dozen automatic checkouts, which you felt obliged to use, or you'd been standing there forever.
There are now 31,000 self-service checkouts in Britain, more than in all the other countries in Europe put together. They don't replace staff, but liberate them to help customers, claim the supermarkets. And their number will double by 2018.
Quantity needed.
My name's Noel Sharkey. I'm Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics at the University of Sheffield.
OK, well, we're sitting at the moment in the cafe of one of the big supermarkets here in Sheffield, and there are automated checkouts, and we've been served by some humans this time. I mean, we tend to think of this automation of human interaction as being something reasonably new.
I know it went back to at least as far as 220 BC with Philo of Byzantium. And Philo had an automatic soap dispenser. You put a coin in, and it was just the weight of the coin dispensed the soap. I've changed my views now of artificial intelligence. I mean, when I started back in the 70s, I mean, they were already predicting that we'd have full natural language understanding by machines by the 90s, at least, and 2000, everything was going to be automated in the world. So we get the timeline wrong, but manufacturers are looking at consumers all the time, and it's that kind of interaction that the scientists could not possibly predict at all.
Automation, he says, has allowed more people to move out of routine work. Secretaries who used to type letters and answer phones are now more highly skilled administrators. It all led to the rise of the virtual receptionist.
Please press 1 to continue hearing this report.
Hi, it's Tom for Russell.
One firm leading the charge in the world of automated phone services is TTNC, run from the site of a former aquarium in Chelmsford. They sell so-called virtual phone numbers to businesses, a landline which exists only in cyberspace and which comes with a package of answering services. Their technical director is Russell Galpin.
The reason that we have different voice artists is when the call is answered, this is the first voice that they're going to hear, so it needs to be how they represent the company. So,
hello and thank you for calling TTNC.
So that's Lisa.
That your call may be recorded for training and monitoring purposes.
That's Lisa. And then Paul, for example, is quite a deep, stern voice.
Hello and thank you for calling TTNC.
My name's Mark Bircher. I'm the Managing Director of TTNC.
How do you feel about all this stuff? Because, you know, some people find it sort of endlessly irritating. They've got to interact with robots and automated computers all the time.
In all honesty, what I feel is that if the service is designed correctly and thought about, it makes the whole process of dealing with a customer much more efficient, which, of course, frees people up to do other things. So it puts intelligent services in the reach of any type of company of any size. One-man band plumbers all the way to corporates, you know, household names.
But the risks for a business of frustrating customers by managing its margins may be fewer in future. The robots themselves are getting smarter. Professor Marianne Bartlett at the University of California creates systems that recognise facial expression. The computer knows if you're happy or not. They're already at work in hospitals helping doctors detect chronic pain. And the day we spoke, she'd been working with a fast food chain.
So the idea is aggregate emotion information that gets emotional response over time from lots of people, whether customers are tending to get angry or annoyed, or whether customers tend to be more satisfied.
So we go into the fast food joint, buy our burger from the machine, and it can then sort of see how happy we are with it.
I would picture this more as general information about when people buy a burger from a kiosk, at the end of the day, do people tend to be happy or not?
And there is an intriguing possibility in all this. Professor Bartlett says the computer often beats people at accurately detecting how a subject is feeling. Something to remember the next time you get the bank's automated answering service. It looks like the machines replacing humans might end up being better at being human than we are.
To end this report and hear from a presenter, press...
That was the BBC's Tom Bateman in England. This weekend marks the 73rd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. The USS Arizona is one of two battleships that remained sunk where it was attacked. Several of the ship's artifacts are at the Arizona Capitol Museum. One in particular will be released soon for the public to see. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
The signal mast and ship anchor are among the most recognizable USS Arizona items at the Arizona State Capitol. Did you know a U.S. flag that flew on the battleship when it sunk during the Pearl Harbor attack will be displayed at the Arizona Capitol Museum starting Sunday?
Part of the reason it wasn't up before is because it had been on display back in the early 90s. And after being on display for a while, it had to rest.
Alice Duckworth is the museum's collections manager.
For conservation purposes, it had to be taken away from the light, had to be taken someplace cool, had to be preserved. We're in the Polly Rosenbaum State Archives and History Building.
We walk into a warehouse-sized room called the Collection Storage Area. Propped up against a desk is a large frame.
And right here is the flag that was on the Arizona when it was sunk on December 7th, 1941.
It wasn't until December of last year when someone inquired about artifacts from the USS Arizona stored at the museum that Duckworth pulled it out. The flag is about 3 by 5 feet, made of wool and has oil stains. Duckworth says although it is a flag that flew on the battleship, it isn't the ship's flag.
This particular flag was salvaged from the ship, and according to the people who were doing the salvage, it had come off either the small boat that was used by the captain or it belonged to the admiral's barge.
The story about the flag is told through a letter that accompanied the banner when it was presented to the museum. The letter was written in May of 1942 by a salvage engineer at Pearl Harbor. It recounts how the flag was recovered and given to the American Legion in Hawaii. It resurfaced around 1990 and given to Arizona. Now, because the flag is in a museum-quality frame, it will be on display for several years. By the way, I did ask, whatever happened with the large flag flown at the stern of the USS Arizona? It would have been about 20 by 38 feet with 48 stars. Duckworth says the flag was flying when the ship sank. She says at some point it was removed, folded, and taken to an officer of another battleship. After that, no one knows what happened to it. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we should know, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Well, if you're in the mood for some good comedy this weekend, the Valley could be for you. Dana Carvey will be performing at the Tempe Improv Sunday evening. He, of course, from Saturday Night Live. He was the church lady, all sorts of other good stuff. Bob Newhart will also be performing Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino tonight. 85 years old, still going strong. Bob Newhart tonight. If Phoenix isn't cold enough for you, you can see what it's like to be in Norway at MIM Saturday and Sunday. Norwegian dancing, food, and music. Also, the Cardinals play the Kansas City Chiefs on Sunday afternoon at University of Phoenix Stadium. The show was produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Alexandra Olgan. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.